Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jennifer Egan, whose latest novel is The Keep. Earlier novels include Look at Me and Invisible Circus, also author of a short story collection, Emerald City. Jennifer Egan, The Keep takes place on multiple levels. One reviewer, Madison Smart Bell, actually, in the New York Times, said you were a metafiction writer. First of all, when I hear stuff like that, I cringe. Secondly, I have no idea what it is.
I find that a little bit of a cringy term, too. I mean, I think what it literally means is that the book is partly about itself being written, which is, in fact, true in this case. So
right.
I guess I'm guilty as accused. I do not like that term because I associate boredom with a term like metafiction and a sort of brainy academic book that's going to be clever and dull. I hope this book doesn't fit that description. But yes, it is metafiction, I guess.
Because it reflects on itself.
Well, one of the plot lines, in a way,
is that it's being written while we're reading the book.
Exactly.
Speaking of that, we've got two stories going on here. One is the story of the Keep. A guy named Danny visits his cousin Howard in this strange castle somewhere in Middle Europe, probably Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic or Slovakia, but we have no idea where it is deliberately, right?
Yes.
And events happen there. It turns out that the story is being written by a guy named Ray, who's in a prison at that particular time in a writing class. You've said that the moment of inspiration for this is that your husband took a job in France, and from there, both of you visited a ruined castle in Belgium.
That is correct, yes. In Bouillon, Belgium, which is fairly near the French border, it was the home of Godfrey de Bouillon, who led the First Crusade. The ruin of his castle is still there, high on a hill, and we trudged up there, because that's what you do when you visit Bouillon, Belgium. And it was a really exciting experience. I walked in there, and I felt this real thrill that it took me a while to understand, but that I knew would connect to fiction in some way.
How much of it is left?
A lot of the structure is there, but a lot of the roofs are missing. I mean, it's not a comfortable place. It's fairly dank and cold and wet, and it was kind of a rainy day. But it's something more than just a few stones on the ground and something less than a cushy tourist site. And it makes you think about how differently space was organized, that each of these was its own little domain. And now it just seems to us like an afternoon's drive, and you can take in, 20 of them.
The actual castle and keep in this is a little bit better upkeep than these ruins that we're talking about. I mean, the castle was usable in this book.
The castle I imagined was one that had been occupied almost continuously since the 12th century. This is all obviously one step removed from reality, but in fact, I posit a single family having owned this castle the entire time and having only vacated it at the very beginning of the 20th century. So it was converted from a castle into a kind of manor home in the 17th, 18th centuries when castle warfare no longer really existed. And then when we find it in the present day, although I don't exactly specify when the book is taking place, it is being converted into an ultra-modern hotel. So, yes, it's habitable. There are rooms and roofs, and parts of it are very decayed, birds roosting in the beds, etc., but other parts have been already renovated. I thought a lot about what this castle should be like, and I actually read a fair amount about castle architecture, the history of castles, the different ways that castles looked in different parts of the world. And at one point I thought, I should have an architect draw me this castle. I'll describe how it should be. And I labored over questions of a concentric wall pattern or whether the keep should have rounded edges, which would mean it had been built later after they discovered that undermining was more effective on a square tower than a rounded tower. And at a certain point I thought, I'm getting too deep into this. The castle needs to be a place that we can't really fathom. And therefore, I don't need to make it so fathomable. So.
Well, on top of that, Ray, who's writing it, the prisoner isn't going to necessarily do that research himself. If you give too much research, to some degree, it blows it.
True, although, of course, there are many point of view questions that are raised because Ray is writing about Danny, the guy who goes to help with the castle renovation, and Danny is certainly from a different socioeconomic background than Ray. We don't know much about Ray, but we have a pretty clear sense that he's probably not from a middle-class family. He's certainly not a writer, whereas Danny, although he has ended up with a fairly feckless existence, was in college at NYU and, a middle-class kid heading out into the world, and so there are definitely questions about how Ray could write Danny. And at times, Danny engages in this very kind of quick-witted repartee in the castle. And the question is, you know, how does Ray really capture that? This is one of the questions that kind of looms, ideally, as you're reading the book. How does Ray know all this? Where is he getting his information?
And we find out a little bit about that later on, perhaps, because the entire thing is also, there's another party involved, which is the writing teacher, and we don't know exactly how much she's contributing to this or what this actually is. And then at that point, there becomes the writer behind it, which is you.
Exactly. And it's also worth saying here that this is really a gothic novel in a lot of ways. And one gothic convention is, you know, an unreliable narrator and texts inside texts inside texts. I mean, even if you think of classics like The Turn of the Screw, we don't often remember this about that story, but it begins as a ghost story that some people are telling at a party, and there's a lot of effort to find this old manuscript, which is where the tale is written that we all think of as The Turn of the Screw. So these framing devices are very common in gothic fiction. And really, the insight that I had when I visited Godfrey's castle, Godfrey de Bouillon, was that I wanted to write a gothic novel with all that that entailed. And one of the really fun things that it entailed was this array of conventions, which I found to be oddly, both sort of artificial and antiquated, and yet oddly well-suited to rendering up modern life, as I was interested in doing in this book.
The book has so many different levels. I mean, it could be read straightforward, but there's so many things going on. It struck me that, you know, how do you create something with so many levels consciously, and how much of it just is unconscious that seems to just fit?
It's a great question. Thank God not all of it is conscious, because I feel like my conscious mind can't actually hold that much. I mean, that being said, compared to my last novel, Look at Me, this is actually a fairly streamlined and straightforward book. So it felt easier to me than that. But I do rely a lot on my unconscious, because the way I write is fairly blind. I mean, I write by hand, and I can't read my writing, and I just roll through it. I just basically generate material sort of like automatic writing. And then out of that begins to come a sense of what I've got here, what might be interesting about it, and what I should do to try to make it closer to what I think it could be. But one of the advantages of writing the way I do is that I don't feel like I'm in control of it. If I'm in control, that's a later part of the process. That's more the editing. But I like to have access to stuff that I'm not thinking about. I don't write about my own life at all. At least not consciously. Of course, later, when I look, I can see all kinds of reasons that I've been interested in a particular set of things. But my impression is that this is coming out of thin air. I am receiving it. It is a surprise to me as much as anyone else. I don't know what will happen. And that's the fun of it, too. But the result is that I'm just sort of opening myself to all kinds of things. And so there's a lot of unconscious there. And then I do take a step back, see what I've got, and try to hone it and control it and harness it. But I am basically relying on all kinds of information that I don't have in my conscious mind.
You mentioned you write by hand. Now, this is, in a way, an anti-technological novel. Beyond that, it's a compact novel. We're dealing with a novel with multiple layers, usually short novels, meaning novels under 250 pages these days are fairly simple and straightforward. And this now makes sense to me. Usually, people, when they're writing on computers, they tend to write 500 or 600-page books because it's so easy to.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to write on a computer. I keep trying. I'm a journalist. I do all of my journalism on the computer. So it's not that I'm a Luddite, but I think the problem for me with a computer and writing fiction is that it's an obstacle to my method, which is this kind of blind writing. If you're looking at a screen and seeing the thought you just had in typeface, that is the opposite of blind. I mean, I feel a compulsion to fix it, to go back, and then that stymies my forward rolling motion, which is what I seem to need to generate all this material. So it is just dead on arrival when I try to use a computer to write fiction, and I am so inept at it that I have a rule that I absolutely do not ever edit when I'm looking at the screen, because there's a huge temptation. I've edited on a hard copy, I'm typing in my changes, and I think, nah, I should change that. Every time I do it, I print it out, and it's wrong. And then I can't figure out how it got wrong, and I realize, oh, yeah, that's the one I did looking at the screen. So my instincts are way off.
I think you have something there, because so many books have gotten to be so bloated, and I think it's because You don't sit there and work with your hands. Your hands don't get tired.
Also, it's interesting because if you never read it in hard copy, you don't have a sense of its physical dimensions as an object. And yet there's a big disconnect there because the reader, unless they're reading it as an ebook, is going to hold it as a physical object. And there's a certain logic to the size of a book. I mean, for example, I knew before I started that it would be short. That was literally a short Gothic novel. That was my goal. Look at Me had been really long. At times it had been really bloated. I mean, I tried to sort of beat it into submission in the end, but it felt unruly and chaotic in my mind, and I didn't want that experience again, although I may next time, but for this one I didn't. You know, that was a defining feature of it. It had to be short. I agree with you. I think there is a lot of bloat out there, and I think the ease of writing on a screen may contribute to that.
Jennifer Egan, the book is about, even though there is no technology in the book, or there's a couple of cell phones, the book is really about how we relate to technology and the imagination. And in looking at your bio, I noticed that you wrote a story from the New York Times Magazine on the secret online lives of closeted gay teens. And it strikes me that the relationship of computers and what we can do with them and how separate we are from them creates this disconnect. And it looks to be that the characters in the book are all trying on one level or another to reconnect.
It's funny that you point to that article because I think that, along with my visit to the castle, are the two inspirations for this novel. It was a really revolutionary experience for me to write that article because, you know, I just turned 44. I didn't grow up with a computer. I'd never used one until I was in college. And, you know, I knew that the internet was changing life, and I'd certainly read about that, and I exchanged email with people. But it wasn't until I wrote that article that I understood that the change was beyond anything I had dreamed, because these were kids living in little southern towns. They were pretending to be heterosexual in their high school classes, football players, all that. And meanwhile, they had these really rich online lives in which they were out. They had relationships. They had circles of friends. They described their home lives as unreal and their online lives as real. And you can understand why, because they were actually themselves online. So that raised all kinds of interesting questions for me, certainly about the notion of reality. You know, if the online part is real and the home is not real, and yet the online part is, you know, disembodied, is this a moment when our old-fashioned notion of reality really does not hold anymore? I don't know. And it was also interesting to me because there were a lot of paradoxes there. On the one hand, their online lives felt more real to them. On the other hand, they were rife with all kinds of disingenuousness because they didn't really know all the time with whom they were communicating. And they were very chilling stories. I mean, the ones you would expect about relationships turning out to be with older men who were really predators, and one guy had actually emailed a picture of his godson pretending that it was he. And, you know, this kid thought he was having a relationship with the godson or with that person who looked like that and was that age, and it turned out it was this older man. And then even more terrifying stories, one of which was a guy who had a whole circle of gay friends with whom he communicated all the time, and they were kind of a posse. And at a certain point, he began to notice that this circle of friends all wrote very similarly. And
it was one person?
It was one person, and it was the one person was a grown man. So, you know, on the one hand, this was reality, where they could be themselves and have true connections. On the other hand, they were never quite sure whom they were speaking with, and I, as the journalist, was never quite sure that they were for real with me. So it was so rich. I mean, as a territory to explore, it was just irresistible.
Throw in the idea, which I think also comes up in a way here, the idea of text messaging. There's an article I read the other day that kids who text message all the time find that those kinds of conversations feel more real to them than one-on-one discussions with people that they actually know in physical life.
Isn't that absolutely freaky? I read that too. And they said, well, you know, you don't have the awkward pauses, and if you don't have anything to say, you just end the conversation. That is totally fascinating.
Then we go back to the fact that Howard is creating this castle where all you can use is your imagination. All cell phones, all electronic devices are banned. Not that people in Middle Europe from America could necessarily use theirs anyway.
Exactly. The idea is sort of great, but as so often when it finds its entrepreneurial expression, it becomes slightly absurd. But he's decided to take the fact that the imagination is underused in contemporary life and make a business out of that by creating a sort of luxury hotel in which people can return to the kind of rich imagined experience that he thinks they had in medieval times when, you know, and he's deriving his knowledge from like medieval paintings where you see devils and angels. And it's a kind of crazy idea. But, you know, in a way, it's an expected part of the mix when there's a sense that the whole notion of reality is endangered and that so much of our experience is mediated. It's no surprise that he comes along and says, well, I'm going to remove the mediation and we'll get back to real, true humanity. In a way, that's just as artificial as saying sitcoms are really artificial. Let's do something really real. Let's do reality TV and it'll be completely real.
And
obviously, you know, it's one more level of artificiality. And interestingly, all of this is anticipated by Daniel Boorstin in his book, The Image, which came out in 1961. And literally every single thing we've talked about, he anticipates. I mean, this was before the Vietnam War had been televised. I mean, the idea that as experience feels mediated, we crave unmediated experience, which the media strives to provide by ever more mediation. It's like a strange catch-22. It's very interesting, worth looking at.
You're listening to an interview with Jennifer Egan, whose latest book is The Keep. Danny uses a word, alto. I've not heard that used. Is that an invention by you?
Yes. Well, I would almost say an invention by Danny because it's not something I had ever thought about until I was writing him. And that's, in a way, gives you an idea of kind of how my wacky method works. But yes, basically what that means, I mean, Danny is a guy who craves complete connectedness. He does not want to feel isolated in his own mind. So for him, alto, he describes it as all-seeing and also being seen by all. It's a kind of perfect visibility as subject and object. And that is the pinnacle of experience for him. And then the converse is something he calls the worm, which is when that feeling of having everything, if you will, begins to get eaten away by a sense that there's nothing there. And in a way, it's an echo with the kind of connectedness technology we've been talking about, because on the one hand, back to the gay teens, there was a sense that, you know, I have it all. I have a relationship, I have friends, I have a whole life. And yet, because it was all disembodied, in a certain sense, there was nothing there. And so I think that paradox exists so often with telecommunications technology. You know, are you connected or are you isolated? Well, you're kind of both.
And you bring that up in Danny's attempts to contact his girlfriend, because the second time, by the end of it, we know it's Danny, and we probably figure it's the girlfriend, but the girlfriend doesn't think it's Danny, and Danny doesn't think it's the girlfriend.
Exactly. And one reason that happens is that Howard, the one who wants to eliminate all telecommunications, raises all these questions in Danny's mind. They have kind of a fight, and he says, you know, how do you know those people are really there? You don't know whom you're speaking with. And Danny's just outraged. And he says, well, of course I do. They're there. And Howard says, they're not there. And Danny doesn't seem to believe a word Howard says. But when he's talking to his girlfriend, he finds himself not believing that it's she. And then he questions her about her identity in such a strange way that she begins to question whether it is he. And by the end, they hang up, both furious, thinking that they've spoken to a stranger, trying to impersonate the person that they love. So it's a definite dissolution of the relationship.
How conscious was that scene to write?
Well, I think that was something that came to me in the moment of writing. I think it was definitely suggested by everything that had come before it, but it didn't occur to me until I was actually writing it that that would be the outcome. And that is just the funnest thing when you're writing fiction. Like when you feel it's that combination. It's the same thing when I'm reading that I like to have a surprise and inevitability. It's the surprise that is suggested by all that has come before it, but that you're not expecting. So I did experience that in the writing.
There's a motif that runs throughout about opened and closed doors and locked and unlocked doors as a metaphor, but also literally the unlocked and locked doors of the caves, of getting into the castle at the beginning, even of Ray being locked inside a prison. How conscious was the door motif as it emerged? And by the end of it, were you going, oh my God, it's all about doors?
No, it was not. That actually was not very conscious. And as you say it, I find myself wincing a little because it really is a pretty clunky piece of symbolism. But I'm going to hide behind my gothic atmosphere and say, but gothic novels are always kind of cheesy, which they are. No, it is a little clunky. And I was sort of dimly aware of it, and I think I just decided to let it be rather than try to extricate it, because it is fairly omnipresent, you're right. But no, that's the kind of thing I would not do intentionally, because it's just too obvious. That being said, I'm not too horrified, because in a way, it's all obvious. I mean, you know, the castle, the keep, the stronghold, you know, this kind of Gothic symbolism really is obvious in a way. And so I'm not sure exactly why that appealed to me so much, except that I had a feeling that using these familiar symbols and trying to jump off from those into less familiar territory would be kind of an interesting juxtaposition. I also think that in a way the technology issue and the doors fit together in a sense, because, you know, when Danny, whenever he makes a connection, when he's making calls with his cell phone or whatever, he's filled with this really sort of unrealistic sense of hope. He feels like he's going to be delivered into some other place. He's waiting for some critical message that will change his life. Because, you know, this kind of communication is about portals of various kinds, maybe just metaphorical. And Danny is filled with a sense of expectation that through those portals will come some kind of transcendent piece of information or escape or something. I think that, in a way, is what interested me most fundamentally about his relationship to technology, that his expectations from it, his hope for deliverance, and both the craziness of that and yet, oddly, the familiarity of it. I mean, there's a little bit of that that I feel myself, or I have noticed that more since writing this book. The connection of that to Ray, a prisoner who in a sense uses the creative endeavor that he's inspired to undertake because of his love relationship really with his teacher, the way in which that provides a kind of escape for him, another door, which he actually does say is cheesy when the teacher brings it up as an example of what writing can do for you. And then the fact that he ultimately gives that back to her and provides a kind of escape from her own life. I guess ideally it's one of these symbols that is both cheesy and very true, I hope.
Well, they're all seeking some kind of escape. Speaking of escaping from one character to the other, the structure of the book, did you know in advance that element of the structure?
The final movement of it?
Yeah.
Not exactly. I knew that I was not going to just be content with the two worlds that I'm alternating between, the American prison and the Middle European castle. So there were a few things I knew I would have to find in the end. I knew that I wanted it to be a little bit less male, because the book is so male. It's one man writing about another man and then about himself. I didn't mind that necessarily, but I just felt that it wasn't quite where I needed to land with this book. And I also had questions about, I mean, we touched on this before, you know, Ray is an unschooled writer, and yet I am suggesting that he has written this novel, which includes first-person discussion of his own life in the prison and then all of this castle stuff. And even though it's not verisimilitude, and I didn't feel held to the standards of, you know, well, could this really have happened? Obviously, none of it could have happened. But I still felt that even given the relationship to reality that I've suggested, it felt like too big a leap to say he wrote this. I had a feeling I was going to arrive at something that would help me solve both of these problems, and that proved to be the case. So I would describe it as another one of those inevitable surprises.
Gothic novels have ghost stories, too.
Absolutely. One of the things that I loved, as soon as I decided to write a Gothic novel, I thought, I love the idea of somehow smashing together the kind of cut-off, gloomy, Gothic, out-of-time feeling with hyper-connected, can't-be-out-of-touch-for-more-than-20-minutes modern sensibility. And when I first dreamed this up, I thought, oh, it'll be so fun to watch the Gothic just subsume the other and just watch it kind of wither in the face of it. And that does happen. I mean, Danny brings a satellite dish, and it's history within a day. It's gone. But the funny thing is that in the end, what I loved about juxtaposing the technology with the Gothic was the similarities between them, because the Gothic environment is this charged place that feels full of the possibility of disembodied communication. And that's exactly what telecommunications gives us. So the opposition actually turned into a kind of analogy or an echo. That was a big surprise to me.
Jennifer Egan, let's look at your career for a second. You were born in Chicago, but you grew up in San Francisco in the 70s. The Invisible Circus, to some degree, arises out of that. Was that the novel that always was in you from when you were a kid?
In a way, except that it's not about me. But yes, I think that the feeling of growing up in the 70s was certainly, in San Francisco, the first kind of defining fact for me. It was a killer to feel that I was just, you know, about 5 or 6 years too late to have really been in the middle of something. I think it gave me my first big thing that I had to say or to look into. In some ways, my concerns were not entirely different in that book, although the context is. I was very interested in the televising of the war and the televising of the news generally that occurred during the late 60s and what kind of impact that had on the counterculture, on its view of itself. Todd Getlin has written really interestingly about this. And others. So I was interested in all of that, but I was also really interested in rendering up the experience of someone who feels they've missed a moment of history, and that was definitely how I felt.
Just 5 minutes too late.
You know, it's probably for the best that I wasn't there, because I may not have gotten too much done thereafter, but I certainly wished I had been.
You wound up leaving and traveling a lot, and the travel was the basis for stories in your Emerald City book. But that came out quite a bit after that, though.
It all happened a bit after, because I didn't publish a book till I was 32. The Invisible Circus actually draws pretty heavily on those travels, too, because it's about a girl whose older sister has committed suicide at the end of the 60s, and the suicide happened in Europe. So the middle part of the book consists of this younger sister taking the postcards her sister had been sending back to her on this basically ill-fated trip and retracing her steps. The itinerary she follows is actually the one I had during my year of wandering around between high school and college. And then I returned to some of those travels for Emerald City, which came out the next year. In a way, those books are almost simultaneous in their creation, but one came out first, the novel.
When you got back from your travels, you moved to New York, and you had a wide variety of jobs. You catered at the World Trade Center. You were also the private secretary to a countess. You have a baroness in the keep. Is there any kind of connection in some of the material I got here? You kind of deny it.
Did I deny it? Yes, there's definitely a connection. I worked for this woman who was American-born but had been a spy with the OSS during World War II, ended up marrying a Spanish count and living as a grandee in Spain for most of her life. She's still alive. She is an amazing character, very colorful and just really an original. She was writing these best-selling books and needed a private secretary, so we wended our way together, and I worked for her for 2 years in New York from 1 to 6 p.m., and she paid me so well that that was all I did. And then I wrote my first two books basically in the morning during those 2 years. So, you know, it was a world that was just so fascinating. I mean, she was linked up with this whole world of deposed European royalty who still took themselves very seriously and I'm sure still do. So she would receive, you know, engraved invitations from Russian princesses whose titles were several lines long. I never had imagined such a thing. It was so fascinating. There is something also very archetypal about the whole idea of a countess. And she had a big temper, and we sometimes went head to head. I always had a sense that there would be some way for her to find her way into my fiction, but I had no idea what it would be. And as I was working on this, I had this idea of putting a count in. And I suddenly thought, well, I've got too many men in this book. I don't need another guy. And then as soon as I thought, let's make it a woman, I went, ah, the countess. Obviously, it's not she. I mean, this woman is sort of a strange apparition, and we're never quite sure if she's real or not. But there are certain echoes between the two, and it was a lot of fun. For example, at one point, the Baroness huffily says that you would never see a European man in shorts. She really disapproved of men in shorts. She thought it was very low class, and that was something verbatim that the Countess used to say. Just funny lines like that, and you know, other things I had never thought about. I swear, from that day forward, when I see a man in shorts, I think, is it okay for men to wear shorts? I guess it's okay for men to wear shorts. And certain other things, you know, she had a very sensitive nose for garlic, and she could tell if I had garlic even a couple of days later, which was really terrible because I eat tons of garlic, but believe me, I cut down during those 2 years. So that was a case where I had to use someone from my life in my fiction, which I don't do often. It was a challenge, but the fact that the Baroness is so out there and basically, in a certain sense, cartoonish, made it easier to use certain things about a real person with affection.
Look at Me is a novel about fundamentalists and terrorists and America today. It's probably, I would guess, just judging from our conversation and having read The Keep, this is your most political novel in many ways.
Yes, I think the Invisible Circus is probably a close second, but yes, it probably is just a bit more so. I mean, interestingly, they both deal with terrorism pretty overtly because the Invisible Circus ends up being quite a bit about the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction in Germany. So I'm obviously pretty interested in contemporary terrorism. I think what always fascinated me about it, and I have a feeling I'll probably leave it behind now for a while in light of current events, but I've always been very interested in its relationship to image culture and the fact that it couldn't exist without the mass media. I was interested in the 60s as a time when the mass media really came to be as we know it now, and not surprisingly, this new wave of contemporary terrorism happened then too, even among pacifist students, or what had begun as pacifist students. And then with Look at Me, I was more interested in Middle Eastern terrorism, which had obviously become much more to the fore in the interim, and its relationship to image culture. The fact that on the one hand, image culture is often a target for that kind of terrorism, something that is really loathed, the way that we've exported all of our Hollywood and other imagery elsewhere, and it has had, in their view, a corrupting influence on cultures, other cultures, and yet at the same time, the kind of what we think of as modern terrorism could not exist without these very same mass media that they abhor. I was interested in that paradox.
That book was written after 9/11, or it begun before 9/11?
It was finished almost a year before 9/11. It came out September 18th, 2001. It's hard to read it now without thinking of those things, but not only had 9/11 not happened, but I was really worried about how people would read what I was writing about terrorism and that they would see it as ridiculous, that I would seem, you know, like I was overreaching and overstepping my bounds. So, no, it was not informed by those events at all.
Does it scare you a little bit that you were prescient a little?
Well, in a way, I wasn't prescient in the sense that my guy does not end up committing any acts of violence. He drinks the Kool-Aid and joins American culture. So I wasn't prescient where it counted, but I think I did have a sense. I mean, there are some lines that are eerie to read now, for sure, about, you know, anticipating some terrible outpouring of violence. I think it was all out there. I think a lot of people were feeling this. I just think it's too bad that the people who were in a position to actually do something about it were not feeling it and anticipating it. The line that always sticks with me from the 9/11 Commission is the failure of the imagination that they talked about among the powers that be. Because really, I think that ideally what an artist is doing is taking in all kinds of information and then just letting it filter through and seeing what stories or images emerge from that. And, I mean, I started reading the New York Times very carefully with an eye toward Middle Eastern terrorism in about 95. So I have the first mention, at least that I've found, of Osama bin Laden in a kind of roundup article about Saudi businessmen who may or may not be funding terrorism. You know, if you were looking and thinking carefully, all I can say is that was where my thoughts went. The problem, the thing that's so hard is that sometimes the one whose job it is to understand what's going on and predict, you know, the politicians or the police men and women, as it were, are receiving so much information that this kind of artistic filtering is not happening. You know, I have a friend who used to work for the State Department, and she said, you know, later you look back and say, well, look, there was this message. Why didn't you respond to that? But what you're not seeing is that that was one of 10,000 pieces of information that day, and there was no guiding principle to show which one really mattered until retrospect, which is the best guiding principle of all. So I think it actually gets a little bit back to the key, because another thing that interested me is the promise of information is that we will understand things as a result of it. But the nature of how it works is often exactly the opposite. The more you know, the less you understand, because raw information doesn't tell you anything. It's the human mind that has to make sense out of all this.
Well, the internet is a cacophony.
Exactly. And, you know, just knowing things is not in and of itself useful. There's a reason that in some ways artists may have, you know, done some filtering or some anticipating that others did not. But it's a tall order when that amount of information is barraging one all the time.
I wonder then about the power of the right-wing pundits in our media and whether that has to do with their ability or the ability, say, of some centralized website with talking points to organize experience for people who otherwise couldn't organize, and then they buy into the propaganda.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in a certain way, a propagandist really has an advantage because they are saying, don't look at the gray areas, don't look at the fine points, just listen to me. Well, that is a lot easier for anyone to do. And it is much harder to say, look at the gray areas, look at the fine points, and see that those propagandists are wrong and that it's more complicated than that. Finding out that it's complicated is a very hard message to hold on to. It's not really a message. It's something much more diffuse. And so I think it's a reason that someone who is simplifying always has an advantage. And, you know, just as a trivial example of this, Look at Me is a very complicated book, and it was a very hard book to talk about. I found myself continually struggling to just explain to people what the book was. So it gives you an example of how whatever you're trying to talk about, if it is complicated and not easily summarizable, you are at a gigantic disadvantage.
How do you function then when writing journalism pieces? We're talking here about, say, organizing principles. In fiction, you could sit there with your pen in hand and just let go whatever happens. But you do have to create organizing principles when you're writing pieces for the New York Times.
Yes. Well, it's an entirely different undertaking. It feels that way from the very beginning. I mean, there the job is to try to synthesize a very complex world, a subculture or a practice or whatever it is that I'm working on, and to render it up with all of its complexities or as many of them as I can, and yet not so many that it's incomprehensible for the reader. So it's a very particular task. It's as if I need to achieve a kind of fluency that will then allow me to explain something, but not in an overly simplistic way, although I certainly have been accused of that, because I think for someone back in the world that I'm writing about, my explanation is often not sufficient. And that's something I've really had to reconcile myself to, is that you really don't end up pleasing everyone. Or sometimes it seems almost that you don't please anyone who's directly involved in the material with these stories, because what they inevitably feel is what we all feel about press, about the job the press does of explaining our world to us, that it's too simple. But I try to do justice to the complexities to the best of my ability, and that is specifically my job. I mean, that's the pleasure of it. I reach a point where I feel that I am so immersed, I know so much, that I'm sort of brimming over with the desire to capture it. And I sit down at the computer, and it takes me about 5 days to write maybe 10,000 words. I'm surrounded by texts and interviews. I'll often have 50, 60 hours of interviews that I've transcribed, and all of it comes into play. It's almost exactly the opposite of writing fiction. With fiction, I begin writing as a way to find a world. With nonfiction, when I have found the world, I very carefully and rather quickly try to render it up in as precise and clear a way as I can without losing any more complexity than necessary.
It makes sense, while I hear you talk, why you use two different methodologies, and when you try to transfer them, they won't work, because this is the two halves of your brain able to stay on either side.
It's really true. It really feels that way. And I think it also explains why I so love to do both. I mean, at this point, my writing mind doesn't feel satisfied with only one of those, although if I had to pick, it would definitely be fiction. But I've gotten kind of addicted to that, the particular pleasure of total immersion followed by a more crystalline writing experience that is the culmination rather than the entry point, as it is with fiction. There is something so complementary about the two of them. And then, as we talked about earlier, the material overlaps as well. So there's a very complex relationship between the two endeavors in my mind. And while I often rail against the nonfiction as I'm doing it and think, oh, why do I have to do this? It's so, I'm taking my
day
time
job,
away from my fiction, day job. Later, I find myself realizing that some of the big impetuses for my fiction have actually come from that, and I did it an injustice by complaining. And it's reached the point now where I have such a faith in the nonfiction to lead me into new, interesting material that I'm planning to do another piece for the Times after the new year, and I'm just excited to see what it will be and where it will lead me.
Well, The Keep has now come out, and you're beginning to think about another novel which will take place in New York post-World War II, is that correct?
I think so. I mean, I say these things, but who knows what will actually happen. But yes, I'm really interested in that post-war moment in New York. I'm interested in trying to connect it with the present, or to sort of try to follow the path of America from then to now to the extent that I can. I'm also really interested in women who worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard during the war, of whom there were thousands, doing very interesting and technical jobs from which they were, of course, fired as soon as the war ended. I've actually partnered with the corporation that runs the Brooklyn Navy Yard now to do an oral history, which will consist of interviewing women who remain from that period who are now in their 80s. And just trying to render up that experience a bit. It seems unrepresented in fiction that I know of, and not terribly well represented in nonfiction either. And I'm interested in a book that covers several generations. I've never done that before. I always try before I start, not really consciously, but I guess now I'm more conscious of it, to find some parameters that will pretty much guarantee that this will be different from anything I've done before, because that gives me that feeling of discovery that I really crave. What I'm really interested in, particularly when I say from then to now, is, you know, the stature of America having helped to win the war, emerging as a superpower for the first time, and then trying to really understand and in some way track the trajectory of America's image and attitude abroad, starting there and arriving now. I mean, what a huge change, and how exactly did it happen? That's not a novel idea, and it's also not a great idea for a novel. I mean, you've got to have some people in there doing things, but that is the question that weighs on me.
You've been listening to an interview with Jennifer Egan, whose latest novel is The Keep. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.